Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moscawain is back tomorrow. For the first time, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton stood together on the debate stage and answered questions. NBC's Lester Holt was the moderator last night. The setting was Hofstra University on Long Island. And this hour, we're going to be talking about what millions of viewers and listeners saw and heard last night, how the candidates presented themselves, how they related to each other, and whether there was a clear winner. We have two guests in studio, and we'll ask you as well what you thought of the candidates' performances. Did the debate change your mind at all about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump? Did it impact your vote in November? The number to call is 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So joining us in studio with their take on the debate are Kelly Dittmar, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Rutgers Camden and scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers Eagleton Institute. Welcome, Kelly.
Thanks for having me.
And Michael Hagan is Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University. Great to have you with us, Michael.
Glad to be here.
So what do you think? Any knockout blows last night? Michael, first to you.
I don't think any knockout blows. No, I don't think there were any big surprises. It was good television. I don't think many people who tuned in came away disappointed or bored. There was a lot that went on, but I don't think either side scored any knockout blows.
Kelly?
I think that that's true. There wasn't any one moment. But I do think that there were a couple of times where Hillary Clinton effectively baited Donald Trump. And that, I think, for her was a win because surely going into this, that was some things that her campaign surely prepared for, right? To try to make sure that they could get him sort of confused, riled up. And there were some moments where you saw him wavering. And I think that that, in her measure and in her campaign's measure, was probably a success.
And we're going to try to get to some of those moments during the hour. We've got some clips from last night's debate. Most of the issues we heard about last night, we have been well trod on the campaign trail. What was interesting, perhaps, was the tone of the back and forth. So let's get to some of the conversation. At one point, Lester Holt asks Donald Trump about why he will not release his tax returns.
I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes. When she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted, as soon as she releases them, I will release my tax returns. And that's against my lawyers. They say, don't do it. I will tell you this. No, in fact, watching shows, reading the papers, almost every lawyer says, you don't release your returns until the audit's complete. When the audit's complete, I'll do it. But I would go against them if she releases her
emails. So it's negotiable?
It's not negotiable. No, let her release the email. Why did she delete 33,000
emails? Well, I'll let her ask that, but let me just admonish the audience one more time. There was an agreement. We did ask you to be silent, so it would be helpful for us. Secretary Clinton.
Well, I think you've just seen another example of bait and switch here.
All right. So a number of issues came up, including he did go there with the emails when the tax returns were brought up. And I'd like to go right to one more clip regarding paying federal income tax. And this is regarding Donald Trump's claim regarding federal income tax. Let's go to it.
He's paid nothing in federal taxes because the only years that anybody's ever seen were a couple of years when he had to turn them over to state authorities when he was trying to get a casino license, and they showed he didn't pay any federal income tax. So
that makes
if
me
he's
smart.
Paid zero.
All right. Well, that's a comment that's getting a little bit of discussion this morning. Is that the last few words that we heard there from Donald Trump perhaps going to come and end up in a TV commercial put together by Hillary Clinton's campaign?
I think that's a fair prediction, yes. There were a number of moments sort of similar to that in which one of the things that was striking was the difference. I mean, we could sit here all day and probably come up with differences between Mr. Trump and previous presidential candidates. But one of the interesting differences is many previous candidates have tried to emphasize the extent to which they're like the ordinary American. They feel the pain of the ordinary American. They understand the problems of the ordinary American and so on. Mr. Trump goes out of his way to demonstrate that he's not like that in some respects. I'm going to get the number wrong, but at some point last night he said he only made $659 million. sort of things like that. He's not concerned about demonstrating to ordinary folks that he's like them. He wants to emphasize the extent to which he has been successful, more successful than almost any of us, at least in the financial realm.
And I think he's also sort of taken pride in gaming the system, right? So he said at one point Hillary Clinton attacked him for not paying contractors or other folks who had done work for him for whom he hadn't paid. And she told a personal story about a gentleman who wasn't paid. He said, well, I just use the law to my advantage and I do it for my business. I do it for my family, et cetera. I'll do it for the country, of course. So he turns it into a positive. Mm-hmm. But I think, again, it's very different approach, not saying I'm like you, I feel you, but in fact, I can strategically navigate this system to get the most out of it for myself, and in this case, in the future, for the country.
I'm not sure he emphasized it enough, but there was I thought one of his best moments was when he said something to the effect that it's about time that the country had somebody in the White House who understands money. And he's pretty clear that he understands money.
Yeah. Well, and many of his supporters say this is why they are voting.
Quite right. Yes, that's quite right. It's not an illogical argument.
Yeah. And they don't seem to mind the fact that the tax returns have not been released.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I also thought with the emails and the tax returns, where you saw the difference in preparation, because I do think there was a difference in preparation between them, Hillary Clinton did not respond to the emails right away, right? Immediately she said, this is a bait and switch. She goes on to attack him. She had a very clear response.
Yep.
Did not want to get into the talk on the emails. Whereas on the taxes, he went down the road of this is why, and I would, and maybe I wouldn't. And I think those sort of succinct responses are the moments where she sort of overtook him in debate prep. And so I think that's part of, you know, where you're seeing some of the difference between them. She then was asked about the emails again. Lester Holt did push her on those. And she had, I think, a one-sentence response. It was very succinct. And I think that's what her folks wanted.
Well, we have a little bit more on that email controversy. We have some sound from that from the debate last night. So let's take a listen.
I made a mistake using a private email.
That's for sure.
And if I had to do it over again, I would obviously do it differently. But I'm not going to make any excuses. It was a mistake, and I take responsibility for that.
Mr. Trump?
That was more than a mistake. That was done purposely. Okay, that was not a mistake. That was done purposely. When you have your staff taking the Fifth Amendment, taking the Fifth, so they're not prosecuted. When you have the man that set up the illegal server taking the Fifth, I think it's disgraceful. And believe me, this country thinks it's disgraceful. It really thinks it's disgraceful also.
Did Donald Trump land any punches here, Kelly?
I think he did to a certain extent. There are a lot of people that are frustrated with the emails. His supporters do care about it. But what I think Michael mentioned this earlier, I'm not sure it got him new voters. So on the emails, I think a lot of folks are also sick of hearing about it. I think it was effective. I think his campaign maybe wanted him to even stay on that and the Clinton Foundation more than came up. But I don't know that it gained him new voters, moderate voters, swing voters.
Michael Hagan.
I think you're certainly right, Kelly, about the difference in preparation. But this is one place where I think Trump was prepared. The response to the tax return question in terms of emails is a good one for him because the email controversy from the perspective of some people makes it seem as if Secretary Clinton has something to hide. And that's exactly the take on Mr. Trump's unwillingness to release his tax returns. He has something to hide. So it's kind of a tit-for-tat strategy that I think was one that they had planned.
An effective pivot, right?
Yeah.
A lot has been made of the different styles of preparation by each candidate for this debate. Were they prepared enough for what they needed to do, each one? I mean, Donald Trump did not spend apparently the hours that Hillary Clinton did in meetings and with prep books and et cetera, but did he do what he had to do?
Well,
I'll
address this in an old-fashioned way. I just happened to have watched some of the 1960 Nixon-Kennedy debate, the first one, with some classes of mine. And one of the controversies or one of the criticisms of Nixon was that he was unprepared in the sense that he didn't have makeup on, he didn't look well, all that sort of thing. But if you actually listen to the words, it's even more striking that he was unprepared to talk about what he wanted to talk about. Kennedy gave the first opening statement. Nixon gave the next one. And he responded, his opening statement began, "I agree with much of what Senator Kennedy has said." And he proceeded from there simply to sort of bounce off of what Kennedy's opening statement had been. That's what Trump did. He didn't have an opening statement. His opening statement was reactive. It bounced off of what Secretary Clinton's opening statement was. And that was a clear – I mean, if you don't have an opening statement, you haven't prepared enough.
Yeah, but did he lose any supporters, do you think?
Well, it's an entirely yeah. different question. So there are lots of analogies we could draw here. Lots of people enjoy looking at paintings without knowing how paintings are made, how one paints a nice painting. I'm one of them. Lots of people could have watched this debate and come away with very different ideas about who won. It seems to me it's unlikely that anybody was really moved one way or another.
Well, the sense I got, and I'm not sure if I'm correct, is that neither one lost anybody in their camp. Certain that voters who are on the bubble were persuaded to go in either direction. Kelly, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's my sense of things. We'll see. And, of course, you can look at the post-debate polls and all are different. So it's really hard to really gauge those and take them quite seriously. I do think in some of the focus groups that I was watching afterwards, there were some folks who are on the bubble. Clinton, who said, okay, she seemed prepared, she seemed on top of it. I don't think that's a huge number, but I do think there might be people who saw that on the preparation, on the content, she spoke more about content, he seemed more agitated, and therefore I might sway to her. But those are people I think that were pretty close already probably to making a decision. I did want to say one more thing about the preparation. I think that also, as much as I do believe she was more prepared, I also think if he was too prepared, it could have hurt him, especially with his supporters. When we've seen him on the teleprompter, it's really unengaging in comparison to what folks are used to, and it hasn't actually worked that well for him. It's prevented some errors, but it hasn't engaged the audiences in the way that his other rallies and such have. So I do understand the campaign probably pulling back and not necessarily forcing him to sit in a room for hours like we know Hillary Clinton did.
I think that's a great point. A big part of the pre-debate coverage was about how Trump had to make himself look presidential.
Yeah.
Part of his appeal is that he doesn't look presidential, and he wasn't about to try to remake himself for the debate. Lots of folks like him exactly because he doesn't seem like an ordinary politician, an ordinary presidential candidate.
Well, and some observers were waiting for Trump to just kind of to lose it emotionally a little bit and go over the top. Did you get the sense that he did that very much at any point?
I think he did it at one point. So I think he did it at the point at the end of the debate when he said he started to get angry because she was needling him. And he said, well, I was going to say something really mean about you.
All right.
But I wasn't going to, and I don't want to do that, but I might do that. And he wandered down that road. And I think that was the moment where he lost it a little.
All right. We're talking about the last night's presidential debate, taking calls at 888-477-9. Kelly Dittmar is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Rutgers Camden. Michael Hagan, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University. We are back with more of Radio Times in just a moment. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton on the debate stage last night at Hofstra University on Long Island. And joining us to talk about it, Michael Hagan, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University, Kelly Dittmar, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Rutgers Camden, and scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers Eagleton Institute. And we've got calls coming in to 888-477-9499 and also comments. Let's get to some of the comments. In particular, I did want to talk just a little bit about moderator Lester Holt. And we have a tweet from Madison who says, wait, Holt was there? there were at times, perhaps it seems as if, Trump being Trump might have been a little overwhelming. And it's particularly toward the end of the debate, it seemed as if Holt tried to jump in and Trump pushed right through and Holt let him go.
Yes, there's plenty of precedent for that. My expectations were shaped a little bit by the Republican primary debates.
Yeah.
And by comparison, this seemed pretty civilized, mainly because there were so many more people on the stage during the Republican primaries. I liked the free-for-all feel of it. I mean, there were moments that were awkward. There were moments when it felt like you'd like one or the other of the candidates to stop talking and let the other one talk. But that's pretty tough to do. I was very sympathetic to Holt going in because I thought Matt Lauer took a lot of heat following.
Yeah, took an awful lot of heat. Well, the next question is, I mean, Lauer took heat because he tossed some apparent softballs Trump's mm-hmm. way mm-hmm. and not so much Hillary Clinton. Last night, how would you describe Holt's performance as moderator, Kelly?
I think part of the fact of him not intervening too much allowed him to be sort of protected from that concern that he was going harder, easier on either candidate. Of course, already the Trump campaign has said that, you know, has indicated that they felt like he was unfair, or at least some of his spin has said that. He did fact check a bit more on Trump than he did on Clinton, according to the New York Times. And so they can call him out for that, but
do you think that he treated the candidates even-handedly?
I think so, in my observation, because of the way he sort of let it go, and he let a lot go. I think it was consistent with what the Commission on Presidential Debates had said ahead of time, which was that their policy or their sort of orientation was to let the candidates debate amongst themselves and for the moderator not to intervene unless need be or for time.
All right. Easier
job because both candidates were in the room than Lauer's was, where he was the only one in the room with each candidate.
So I think that's true.
Holt was able to back off more, and I think it worked.
All right. We're going to get to some of the calls. David in Flemington has actually a question related to what we're talking about. Hi, David.
Hi. Thank you. I believe Lester Holt was outstanding, but I also believe the remaining presidential debate should be canceled. And here's why. I think we as the public and the voters well have seen their personal characteristics through the debates and otherwise. Their policy positions are well known in detail, and the debates, I believe, are not going to have any effect on the electorate. Thanks for my chance to make a comment.
And you're welcome, David, and thanks for the call into Radio Times. Well, really, what did the debates do to move anything for the electorate forward in the election? What is typical?
Well, I think it's true that, you know, debates don't necessarily make or break candidates. Often we say if somebody did really poorly, it might make a huge difference. At the same point, I do think there is a aspect of debates that should be about education for folks who aren't as engaged as we are or your callers are in watching the presidential election. So while the caller may know all their policy positions and may know them quite well, I'm not sure that is true of all voters. And so I think there is a value of having a debate on, you know, the main TV channels, 90 minutes on a weeknight, and hope that maybe some folks opted for that over Monday Night Football.
Michael Hagan.
Well, I certainly agree with the view that not too many people were moved in one direction or another. That's historically been the case, especially when you take into account the full stable of debates. One debate might move folks one way or another, but typically the subsequent debates move them back the other way. I suspect that the next debate will be very different from this one.
How so?
Well, I suspect that – do I really want to say that Mr. Trump will spend more time preparing? I think that he probably will. I think that he'll be better prepared for the kinds of tactics that Secretary Clinton used. I don't know whether the town hall format will benefit him or not, but I suspect that he'll spend some more time preparing for the next one.
Okay. Well, as we know, Hillary Clinton had some health issues not too long ago. She had to deal with a bout of pneumonia. And Trump kind of went there last night talking about physical stamina. So let's take a listen.
I don't believe that Hillary has the stamina.
Let's let her respond.
Well, as soon as he travels to 112 countries and negotiates a peace deal, a ceasefire, a release of dissidents, an opening of new opportunities in nations around the world, or even spends 11 hours testifying in front of a congressional committee, he can talk to me about stamina.
The world, let me tell you, Hillary has experience, but it's bad experience. We have made so many bad deals during the last. So she's got experience, that I agree, but it's bad, bad experience.
As you can hear, there were people from both camps in the audience last night. And as an aside, Lester Holt had asked audience members not to cheer, not to applaud. I think they behaved themselves in general throughout the debate, but at some point they did, you know, there was applause, et cetera. So just from hearing what happened with the audience, it doesn't seem, again, that either candidate made more than a point to their mm-hmm. camps.
Mm-hmm. It was,
is that an accurate observation Michael Hagan?
Another analogy. It was like a heavyweight bout where both fighters are landing blows, it seemed to me. I think Trump's line, "You have experience, but it's bad experience," is a pretty good line.
Yeah.
I think Secretary Clinton's response to the stamina issue, while clearly something she had prepared, she delivered it well, and I think it probably carried the day with lots of folks. It made a lot of sense to lots of folks, so both sides were pretty happy with that.
I think, you know, before the debate, of course, I'd been asked questions about, is there going to be coded language? What sort of coded language might he use around gender? This is hardly coded language around gender, right? So the questions about her stamina that he's been raising since December of 2015, if you look back, he raised this first after one of the Democratic debates where she had gone off and she was in the bathroom and he said, oh, she must have been sleeping. So he's raised questions about her stamina throughout. And I think it's not only to point out and sort of cue feminine weakness or vulnerability or frailty, something that is common in when we stereotype women, but also to try to present himself as the strongest, toughest, manliest candidate. And that's been a strategy that he's been using throughout the campaign. He's been playing that masculinity card from day one, and he's been playing it against women and men. And I think this is yet another example. When he was asked about the question, you know, about a presidential look, he also couldn't respond to that. So if we're trying to see if he can reach some of the voters who he doesn't have, particularly among women, Republican women, among whom his unfavorables are really high, that sort of coded language, that sort of gendered attack is not going to help.
Well, as Mara Liasson pointed out last week on NPR, gender communications research shows that, you know, men, when they're aggressive, are received positively. Mm. When women are perceived as aggressive, they are received negatively. How did Hillary Clinton strike the balance last night? She seemed to be making an effort to be calm.
Yeah.
And not to let Trump get under her skin.
Yeah.
And she also smiled an awful lot.
So there was a tweet this morning from an Atlantic editor who said, you know, who told her to smile so much? And I started listing the names, Reince Priebus, Joe Scarborough, all these men who've told her to smile more. So definitely, I think that she very much rehearsed what was her split screen look. Right. And how is she going to respond and react to Donald Trump's comments and not to appear too serious, but also to be sure that she was serious enough? And this is a balance that men and women strike, but it is something that women have to deal with. And the questions around likability and niceness are things that women have to deal with in ways men don't.
Well, what do you think of the fact then that she apparently made an effort to play into that?
Well, I think she was making an effort not to disrupt voter expectations, right? So if voters think that women need to appear more likable, she was going to try to demonstrate that she is, in fact, likable. I don't think she overplayed the hand, I guess. You know, I think smiling and being pleasant is actually somewhat in her nature. But I do think she was cognizant of it.
Michael Hagan.
The difference between the two of them in the split screen was interesting. And another element of the preparation, I think. I mean, it wasn't a surprise to them, obviously, that there was going to be this split screen approach. All of those kinds of things are negotiated by the campaigns with the television networks in advance. So they knew exactly how that was going to work. And Mr. Trump didn't seem to have a at times he didn't seem to be aware that the camera was on him, which was kind of odd, it seemed to me. So
he's pretty comfortable in front
of
the camera.
Well, he's very comfortable. And so maybe I was just misreading it. Maybe that's just the way he exudes comfort in front of the camera. That may be. And maybe the contrast with Clinton was that she was – obviously she had a way that she wanted to look when she was on split screen when he was talking, especially when he was saying something that just with which she disagreed.
There were quite a few tweets about Donald Trump needing to smile more. So I think, you know, folks are trying to level out the commentary last night.
All right. Let's continue with our telephone calls. Tatiana in Ewing, New Jersey. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. I wanted to tell you that I'm just appalled at the way that you all are addressing this entire issue. You seem to be behaving or... Yeah, you appear to me to be behaving as if you believe that this is just a campaign, you know, another campaign in our history between two people who are, you know, approximately okay. And you're, you know, talking about whether she smiled enough or she smiled too much or like, my gosh, we have a candidate who has stated such incredibly outrageous things, who at every single appearance has multiple lies coming out of his mouth.
So, Tatiana, since we are wait, let me just jump in because we've got time constraints. Which candidate, and if you could, are you talking about referring to at the moment? And if you could just in about 30 seconds, you know, condense your thoughts, that would be great.
No, in 30 seconds, my thoughts are that I'm outraged that the press is behaving as if this were just a normal campaign. This is not. This is a campaign between a candidate who is qualified, who has shown that she has qualifications, who has done things that is qualified, and another candidate, Donald Trump, who every single time he opens his mouth, he makes these outrageous statements and lies, and none of you seem to be focusing on that.
Well, Tatiana, thank
and
you
I
so
think
much.
You're performing a real disservice to the American public.
We appreciate the call to Radio Times. It's an unusual campaign, and yet both candidates have been nominated by their respective parties, the voters, to be the standard bearers, their major party candidates. So really, in a campaign like this, what is the proper treatment that the media need to give these candidates?
Oh, okay. I'll answer that.
I'm throwing that one to you.
Boy, they have been struggling with this from the very start, haven't they? And, you know, lumping the media together these days under a single umbrella is probably a mistake. But lots and lots of reporters and editors have been struggling with how to cover Mr. Trump from the very start. I think partly that's because when he announced his candidacy, they found his story to be one they could not resist. It was terrific TV. He's very good on television. He is very good at attracting attention to himself. He's good at some of the things that he's done over his career, and the press went for it. I think then there was a sense among some reporters and editors that they had gone overboard and that they needed to address the content of what he was saying and not just the manner in which he was saying it. I think it's been I'm ducking the question in just the way that reporters and editors have had a hard time struggling with this question. I teach classes about this, and I'm not going to stand in front of – I don't feel it's my place to stand in front of my class and tell them who the good candidate is and who the bad candidate is. But is it my place then to tell my students which candidates are lying and which candidates are not lying? I mean, that's really not – I don't see that as my job either. Yeah. I'm there to help them to evaluate and criticize and think critically about what both candidates are saying and reach their own conclusion.
I think two points on that. I do think that sometimes we do negate the fact that there is media that are fact-checking and are doing investigative reporting and are asking tough questions. And so I think lumping all the media together sometimes misses out on that. So I think there have been a lot of issues around media coverage in this race. But to negate that, I mean, you can look at – there's hundreds of fact checks just from last night that media are participating in. The other piece of this that I think we have to be careful about, and this includes callers like Tatiana who are really frustrated, there are folks who are frustrated on the other side too, who support Donald Trump and believe Hillary Clinton's the candidate who's a liar, who's, you know, presenting a different face to the nation. Yeah. And I think really understanding that and understanding where both sets of voters are coming from and the real sort of ire that – both have for the other side is part of our jobs, particularly as scholars, to look at sort of what's causing that and how does any candidate and how does the media address it.
Yeah. And we want to do all that without in any way trying to quell the passion that Tatiana showed. You know, it's wonderful that people are so involved in this election. I think it's great that people have strong feelings about this. We want to encourage strong feelings.
All right. Well, let's get to more of our comments. Chuck asks, why are billionaires so visible, vocal, and involved this time around? Media, Citizens United, seems like a lot more before. Trump and Clinton's wealth is disturbing. I find it alienating. It is interesting because, you know, they're appealing to different segments of the population. But the fact is, you know, they are wealthy people.
I mean, I think both of them, this is partly why you look at their favorability numbers. And again, the sense that you can, they are like you. That's one of the measures we look at in campaigns. And I think both of them struggle on that front. One thing that you didn't see last night that I think may be come through in the town hall, if either of them are more effective in that that format, is some of that empathy that they can demonstrate. So I'm not only a billionaire or a millionaire or whatever they might be, but I actually share the same story. Hillary Clinton tries to do this in talking about her family. She talked about her father in the opening statements last night and really contrasted him with Donald Trump. Donald Trump hasn't done as much of that, in part because, as Michael made the point earlier, he's really taken pride in the fact that he is different, that he's a billionaire, that he succeeded. So I think, you know, they are two different candidates on that, but they both have struggled with making the case to voters, we're like you, we understand you.
All right, we've got a tweet from Kristen. We'll try to squeeze this in right before the break. Why do you think at Hillary Clinton did not respond regarding her ads that they are predominantly compiled from his own hate speech? I'm not sure if I understand that.
I'm not sure I understand it.
I actually tweeted about this for Presidential Gender Watch
last
night. All right,
thank Kelly Dittmar.
So he said at one point, her ads are so mean. If you look at her ads, they mostly are actually clips from his own comments. And so I think folks, including our project, wanted to say, okay, well, but they're your words. So if you thought they were mean, perhaps you should apologize.
All right. More on the presidential debate, last night's presidential debate, after the break here on Radio Times. We're joined in studio by Kelly Dittmar, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers Camden and scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers Eagleton Institute. Also, Michael Hagan is associate professor of political science at Temple University. And we've got calls coming in to 888-477-9499. Keep it here. There's more of Radio Times straight ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we are discussing the presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump at Hofstra University last night. Michael Hagan is here with us in studio. He is associate professor of political science at Temple University. And we're also talking to Kelly Dittmar, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers Camden. And again, the number to call is 888-477-9499. So touching some more on the issues that came up last night, Donald Trump, of course, says he would be the law and order president if he were to be elected. And he, at one point, discussed his feelings on the homicide rate in the inner cities. Let's take a listen.
We have a situation where we have our inner cities, African-Americans, Hispanics, are living in hell. Because it's so dangerous. You walk down the street, you get shot. In Chicago, they've had thousands of shootings, thousands, since January 1st. Thousands of shootings. And I'm saying, where is this? Is this a war-torn country? What are we doing? And we have to stop the violence. We have to bring back law and order.
And Trump later went on to defend stop and frisk and also to talk about community relations with police. But those are some strong words, living in hell. How did that play last night, Michael Hagan? What was your reaction when you heard that?
Well, first of all, to people of a certain age, law and order is a phrase that just jumps out, you know, reminding us of President Nixon talking about law and order in the late 1960s, early 1970s. I think most people are in favor of order. I don't think that's an issue. It's unclear. It was unclear to me where Mr. Trump was proposing policy changes that would address the issue of violence and so forth. So it wasn't.
Was he actively reaching out to the African American community here?
I don't think so. It was interesting to me and refreshing that they spent so much time talking about the issue of race. It was disappointing, although perhaps understandable, that so much of that conversation was about violence and about gun violence in particular. But I don't think that his pronouncements on the issue were really intended to appeal to minorities, especially to African Americans. I think he's the law and order phrase is one that that rings clearly to white Americans, especially suburban white Americans, I suppose.
Well, Trump, Kelly Dittmar has been making an effort in recent weeks to go into the African American communities across the country, and if not in a conciliatory way, trying to get a number of folks on board with his.
Yeah, campaign. I mean, I think I'm sort of in line with a lot of the commentators who have quickly noted that it's not so much that he's trying to win over black voters, but that he is trying to win over some of the suburban voters, the college-educated white voters who are concerned about voting for somebody who they feel might have said racist things or has sort of a bigotry in any way in his past and are uncomfortable with that. And so I think a lot of these appeals to say, I'm reaching out, I'm going to try to help the African-American community, is actually not directed at the African-American community. This is demonstrable through the fact that he's made these comments before about black Americans living in poverty, living, you know, going to get shot going down the street. And many black Americans have said, excuse me, that's not our reality. And so I think he didn't change his tune. That means he's not actually trying to speak to those voters.
All right. Back to the phones we go. Louise in Camden, you are live on Radio Times. Hi, Louise.
Hi. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So what's your question or comment?
My question is, I've been living in this area, and previous politicians have always stated the same policies that Hillary is stating that she's going to do. Well, how this time is going to work differently?
So do you have any thoughts about specific policies?
Well, my reaction is I think another of Mr. Trump's good lines was, it's all talk. You've been at this for 30 years and nothing's changed.
Yes.
It's time for a change.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the pitch a challenger makes. The person who's running against the party of the incumbent president, in some ways, it's a very conventional type of appeal, and I think it's probably an effective one.
Mm-hmm. All right, onward we go. Thanks, Louisa, for the call to Radio Times. David in Philadelphia, you are up next.
Yeah, as soon as I can.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you there, Dave? Are you leaving us for a moment? All right. Well, we'll have to get back to Dave. You are there.
I'm here. Yep. I'm
okay.
Here.
Well, welcome. Welcome.
Thanks. Here's my question. Many of us felt in 2000 that we had seen the worst presidential candidate of all time versus Al Gore. And he looks like Abraham Lincoln now compared to Donald Trump. And I agree with the woman earlier who said something about this isn't a normal election. We're talking about the way people look, but we really have a serious problem. And I agree. And here's my question. When you have a candidate who consistently lies like this, when you have a candidate who is fomenting racial divide, who is slamming women every chance he gets, who is doing the things that he's doing, and I'm not suggesting an answer by my question. I really want to know what you think. The question is, does the media at some point have an obligation to stop being neutral and to say, hold on here, this is just too dangerous. We can't go down this road. And does the media have an obligation to step in at some point, or do they have to do what they can to just remain neutral? And I'll hang up and listen.
All
thanks.
Right. Thanks, David, for the call. Have the media been too neutral? Kelly Dittmar.
You know, it goes back to this question to me of sort of which media are you talking about? So I think there's surely great examples of the media not being neutral in this race. You can choose which news you want to take as your news. You can choose which channel to tune into, which radio station to turn on, and you can probably get a different view of this election. So I do have a hard time. I definitely don't think we have to. We want to tell the media to intervene in the ways in terms of biasing towards any candidate. On the flip side, I do think there are moments in this race where we should call things as they are. We've been doing this project for the Center for American Women in Politics called Presidential Gender Watch 2016. We are a nonpartisan project. We're a nonpartisan center. But when there are times where a candidate says something that's misogynistic or sexist, we have to call it out. And that would be true if Hillary Clinton said it or Donald Trump said it. So it does create challenges for all of us.
All right. Let's talk about gender for just a moment. And we've got one more clip before we get up to the top of the hour here. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump talking about his record on statements about women.
This is a man who has called women pigs, slobs, and dogs, and someone who has said pregnancy is an inconvenience to employers, who has said women don't deserve equal pay unless they do as good a job as men. And one of the worst things he said was about a woman in a beauty contest. He loves beauty contests, supporting them and hanging around them. And he called this woman Miss Piggy. Then he called her Miss Housekeeping because she was Latina. Donald, she has a name.
Where did you find
her? Name
Where
is Alicia Machado.
Where did you find her?
And she has become a U.S. citizen, and you can bet she's going to vote this November.
Okay, good. Let me just tell you.
Mr. Trump, it's going to take 10 seconds, and then we're going to have the final question.
Hillary is hitting me with tremendous commercials. Some of it said in entertainment. Some of it said somebody who's been very vicious to me, Rosie O'Donnell. I said very tough things to her, and I think everybody would agree that she deserves it, and nobody feels sorry for her. But you want to know the truth? I was going to say something extremely rough to Hillary, to her family, and I said to myself, I can't do it. I just can't do it. It's inappropriate. It's not nice.
So we've got a number of issues there in that clip, which was just over a minute, and somehow Rosie O'Donnell made it back back into the conversation. Kelly Dittmar, how do you parse this? And also, too, you know, almost despite what Donald Trump may or is perceived to say about women, he's got a lot of women who support him, and it just doesn't seem to really face them.
Sure, he's got a lot of women, but he's got less women than any Republican candidate to date. So he is doing worse even among women in his base. But it isn't to negate all the women that do support him. I do think, in terms of Hillary Clinton, that was probably one of the most planned parts of the debate. Mm-hmm. They had a video up ready to go the moment she said that, or I think it went on actually right before the debate. It hit on immigration, it hit on racism, it hit on misogyny, all of the things that she's tried to paint him as sort of, you know, not presidential enough on these measures. And I think his response was demonstrated that this is the stuff that really gets at him. And he hasn't responded well. He didn't respond well to Megyn Kelly when she hit him on this. He hasn't responded well in interviews since. And he didn't respond well last night. To pull out Rosie O'Donnell and say she deserves it and nobody feels sorry for her, that's actually not true of a lot of women throughout this country.
Yeah.
And so he again sort of showed a lack of care for the negative things he said about women. And I should add, this is the ad that's playing here in the Philadelphia area right now, which is young women looking in the mirror and hearing Donald Trump's words about women. And obviously the Clinton campaign finds this to be effective.
And yet his response last night was not nearly as bombastic as it was to Kelly,
sure.
to Megyn Kelly. So what do you see here?
Well, I think responding by saying, I could say something really nasty, but I'm not going to, is not probably the most effective way to respond.
But to his supporters, does that show restraint? It almost seemed to me as if perhaps that's
maybe
where he was going with that. I've got this information, but you know what? I'm not going to release
Maybe so. You know, the pregame positioning with the possibility of Jennifer Flowers being in the audience and so forth is all.
Well, Mark Cuban, too.
Yes.
Started with that. Yeah.
Right. I guess I would like to say something to the previous caller with respect to news media's performance and to an earlier caller who said, let's call off all the rest of the debates. So maybe there's nothing maybe lots of us are not learning anything new from these debates. Some of us are. But to those of us who are dissatisfied with the way the news media have performed, here's an opportunity to hear the candidates speak without much in the way of interruption from journalists, not much analysis, not much spinning, not much interpretation. It's unvarnished presidential candidates. And I think that's the virtue of the presidential debates, is you actually get to hear these people talk. Now, sure, they've prepared, they know what they're going to say and all that sort of stuff, but it's them and you. And I think there's a lot to be said for that.
And we've got a lot of callers here today. We're going to try to get to perhaps one or two more. Charles is in Philadelphia. Charles, you're live on Radio Times.
Hi. I wanted to mention that there were candidates who were on the ballot across the country who were left out of the debate, and encourage listeners to check them out. Particularly, I support Jill Stein, and her responses were live tweeted at jill2016.com.
Yeah. Charles, thank you very much for the call to Radio Times. And again, you have to make that 15% or you're not going to get onto the national stage. And really, how does this affect the national conversation when you don't have the third party candidates involved?
I don't think it has much of an effect. It's unfortunate. I guess the good news is there are more and more ways for people to get news about candidates other than the major party candidates through the internet. I think it's terrific that people have access to that kind of information.
Kelly?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is expected. This is sort of how we've had these debates in the past. It would be hard to include everybody. But you have to make some standard rules. I do think that Michael's right. In order to get the information, there is a benefit of new media, social media, and online media.
All right. Let's get to Lynn in Philadelphia. Lynn, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment in general about last night's debate. First, I really felt that Lester Holt was not prepared. People are saying he was fact-checking Trump more. I found him fact-checking more on his direct questions that he was asking. And when Clinton would respond with something, he was not prepared with the facts for her response. And on that note, to have a moderator be more prepared, I would like to see in a future debate perhaps video clips being used of the candidates making statements in context in advance of the question at hand, so that there is none of this, "I didn't say that," "Yes, you did." "No, I didn't." "Yes, you did."
Well, we appreciate the comment to Radio Times, Lynn. A couple things there. An interesting concept, having video clips at the ready. How practical is it when you have a debate? And also, too, as you alluded to earlier, Michael Hagan, is this the role of the moderator to be a fact checker, large way or small way?
Well, I was just singing the praises of unmediated interaction between the candidates and the voters. I would hate to see video. I mean, I understand the motivation for having video clips in there. I understand the motivation for having a moderator who's more proactive. But I think letting the candidates go at it is probably the most effective way. And you know, one of the good things about having more than one debate is there can be more than one format. So it's nice that we'll get a town hall format next time. It's nice that there'll be multiple questioners in the third debate. I think all those things are to the good.
And Kelly Dittmar, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, these folks are running to be president of the United States. They should be prepared to call out their opponent on things that are, you know, factually incorrect. That's part of the role of the debate. I don't necessarily think that's the role of the moderator or the network to put on videos to prove them wrong.
And quickly, ABC's Martha Raddatz, CNN's Anderson Cooper are up next, moderating the second debate, October 9th. Chris Wallace of Fox News does the third. Are we going to see much difference in styles and approach, do you think, from these moderators?
Oh, I guess I thought there was going to be more than one for the third debate.
Mm-hmm. I don't, there might
yes,
be. I
yeah.
read
no,
Chris
no, no,
Wallace.
No, 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 I think you're probably just, right. Yeah. In a word, yes, I think these are four very different people who take somewhat different approaches to their craft, and they'll be very different in the questions they choose to ask.
Yeah, I wonder what we'll learn.
Yeah.
Stay tuned,
and we'll see a woman moderator next time.
Kelly Dittmar, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Kelly Dittmar is assistant professor of political science at Rutgers Camden and scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers Eagleton Institute. And Michael Hagan, our thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Michael is associate professor of political science at Temple University, and Marty Moskowain is back tomorrow. She will likely do more, some further analysis of last night's debate, so be sure to join her for that. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and you are listening to Radio Times.